Welcome Inside Appalachia, I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky lawmakers face tough money decisions this year.
Kentucky, like many states, faces limited public resources.
Is West Virginia moving from blue to red?
In West Virginia, the transition is slower and at different levels.
Some Pennsylvania artists find a good use for acid mine drainage.
Some potters like larger sizes, some like raw materials, some like it very fine.
And bird counters are documenting the winter population.
Ducks, or Dad said like a tree sparrow would be a good bird to see, or a snowy owl would be a really good bird.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia, I'm Cecilia Mason. We move from the holiday season to the political season when legislators get ready to head to their state capitals for this year's session. A new report says Kentucky lawmakers must either raise revenue or make drastic cuts to services. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter reports that a study from the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy paints a bleak outlook for the state's upcoming budget.
When lawmakers meet next week to begin the process of hammering out Kentucky's next biennial budget, they'll be faced with two choices. Jason Bailey is the director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. He says in order for the legislature to fully fund priorities like education, public employee pensions, and more, lawmakers will have to raise potentially $1 billion in revenue that the state doesn't have. The alternative, Bailey says, is to continue to fall behind other states that have made those investments. He advocates comprehensive tax reform as a major step in lifting Kentucky out of its economic funk. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
Kentucky lawmakers are being asked to consider a new proposal for privatizing certain services or projects. WEKU's Stu Johnson explains.
Privatization is not new to Kentucky state government. It was used in a significant way to house inmates across the Commonwealth for decades. The state cut its tie to privately run prisons earlier this year. The number of inmates housed in prisons has been on the decline. There were also sexual abuse of inmate allegations and complaints by shift supervisors, allegations denied by the private firm. Bob Gray worked in state government for a quarter century before going into consulting. He believes private firms can be key players in the public arena.
Kentucky, like many states, faces limited public resources, and creating a process that would encourage private partners to make investments to help provide public facilities in Kentucky and services would help our tax dollars go farther and would create services facilities that we might not get some other way.
One of the most high-profile recent examples of privatization is the large student housing project at the University of Kentucky. UK Vice President for Facilities Management Bob Wiseman says borrowing to cover high deferred maintenance costs for existing dorms would have meant a long extended process. The UK administrator says going the private route offered efficiencies of scale, cost, and time.
I think you always have to look at privatization critically as to the why and when you use it and make sure it makes sense. And I think that's what we did. We were very careful in how we approached the topic, and it made sense for residence halls. Whether it would make sense on other projects, other people will have to determine, but I think we'll always be cautious on when we use it. But it has advantages in some cases.
A legislative initiative in 2014 could move the privatization discussion further along. Bob Gray says it follows a Virginia model where state government and private sector representatives sit down to review proposals.
Would allow private partners to come forward with proposals to provide certain services or facilities and put those proposals on the table and evaluate them through a cost-benefit analysis to ensure that the public really would benefit from it and it would be a good deal for taxpayers.
Gray says privatization could help in everything from building rest areas along highways or other facilities for state government to providing certain social services. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
Under the Affordable Care Act, Kentucky chose to expand Medicaid eligibility, which means an additional 300,000 Kentuckians now qualify for health care coverage. But with more patients able to visit primary care physicians comes a problem. There aren't enough doctors. Kentucky Public Radio's Whitney Jones has more on why rural areas have difficulty recruiting those physicians.
Dr. Emery Wilson is the director of University of Kentucky's Office of Health Research and Development. He says Kentucky still has a shortage and faces some new obstacles, in addition to expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
The other thing that lends itself to an increasing need for physicians is the aging population and the more chronic diseases that people have. And that tends to be worse in rural areas, too.
In a 2012 healthcare report, a Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky panel of healthcare professionals said the biggest issue in rural communities was the provider shortage. In a May 2013 Deloitte and Kentucky Health Benefit Exchange report found the neediest area for primary care physicians was a western 8-county region stretching from Graves to Allen. Why Kentucky and other rural areas are short on doctors is a complicated answer. It's part young doctors' lifestyle and desire for urban living, part struggles for reimbursement, and simply not enough rural medical training programs. Madisonville family physician Dr. William Crump with the University of Louisville directs one such program. He says the influx of specialty doctors is part of the primary care shortage.
If you look at the countries around the world that provide really top quality care, really at quite a bit less cost than we do in the United States, it's about 70% primary care and 30% subspecialty. That percentage seems to be the magic ratio that gives the best care. In the United States, we're reversed.
Dr. Elisa Marzek was one of Crump's residents. The thin woman with kind blue eyes and long brunette hair waits for her patients to arrive at the Baptist Health Hopkinsville office as the television plays in the waiting room. In one fell swoop, Marzek explains a large aspect of the shortage.
In medical school, most of my colleagues decided they wanted to do a specialty. Well, specialists can't survive in small towns. You need the primary care. And because so many students in the medical school want to go to specialty, there aren't as many primary care residencies. Because there's fewer primary care residencies, there become fewer primary care physicians, which means fewer physicians in the rural settings.
Crump says most physicians interested in serving rural communities come from a rural background, and that those who choose that path are important to keeping the Commonwealth healthy. But Dr. Emery Wilson at UK has had access to medical students' questionnaires and found some troubling news about students outside the Commonwealth.
Almost no one from those other states say that they plan to practice in Kentucky. If we want more physicians in the state, we're going to have to train them ourselves.
The Rural Physician Leadership Program aimed to do just that in Murray and was initially set to begin in 2014. RPLP was planned to be a partnership between Murray State, the Murray-Callaway County Hospital, and the UK College of Medicine. The program would host 10 students in their third and fourth years of clinical study as they rotated between hospitals throughout Western Kentucky. But MCCH Vice President of Institutional Advancement Keith Travis says the program didn't come to fruition.
Long story short is that Dr. Wilson retired from UK as dean. Then UK got a new hospital president and a new university president. Murray State got a new president. And there's been so much change and everything on the program right now, the program's on hold.
Travis says a Murray physician is still working on bringing something like the RPLP to the region, but admits there is still much work to be done. Meanwhile, Elisa Marzek continues to develop her practice in Hopkinsville, serving people who sometimes drive from counties over just to see her. She says during her first week, her schedule was full and that she continues to stay busy. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Whitney Jones.
One of the main things you hear when you ask people why they love Appalachia is it provides a strong sense of place. But as essayist Kat Pleska points out, that concept can be more difficult for some.
Recently, a friend wrote to me and asked, "How does it feel to be so deeply rooted in your Appalachian community, to know that you belong from the past and forward?" This was not an idle question for her. Born in Korea, adopted by Americans, and brought to the United States as a child, she moved often around the South. When she married, she moved due to jobs. Now, she's arrived to yet another address. In an effort to belong, and to reach back to her roots, she has approached both Korean and Korean-American groups in her area. But after so long, she feels she might not fit within either. Answering my friend is difficult, as a sense of belonging is individual, but one way I feel I am comfortable in this region is through language. She tells me she is attempting to improve her skills in her native language. Without language that is familiar and shared, we feel as an outsider, our identities unsure. In fact, many of us in Appalachia often defend our speech patterns to those outside our region. While we can wish no one judged us by our dialect, it is a fact that many do. Despite my occasional grumblings and wishes West Virginia or Appalachia was this or that, this rumpled land is my first love. I feel a deep connection to my welcoming hills and its spirited, friendly people. This is still a land rich with stories, and storytelling is a long-honored tradition to pass along family history and the region's tales and legends. I am the recipient of many family stories, not unlike the stories of other families throughout Appalachia. Sharing experiences creates a strong bond and deepens our sense of personal history in one place. In this way, we know who we are and where and who we come from. Perhaps my friend can find an audience for her stories and maybe begin with what she remembers of Korea. I understand her strong desire to feel rooted and settled. But the truth is, even if you are from a place of many generations, each of us has to learn to fit. Perhaps belonging is a willful sense, an emotion for which we must constantly work. I hope her communities reach out to let her know she has truly come home. If not, then the niche we carve for ourselves in any area must be the beginning of a new history, collecting our stories of experience on into the future. Maybe we are the ones who create the place where we feel we belong.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In this midterm election season, we'll no doubt be hearing a lot about red states, blue states, and purple states, where voters tend to elect Republicans, Democrats, or can swing either way. West Virginia has traditionally leaned Democrat and still has more registered Democrats than Republicans. But as West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara reports, some political scientists see signs that West Virginia is changing.
There's always been the debate, to which region does West Virginia belong? Former Senator Robert C. Byrd was famously quoted as saying, West Virginia is the most northern southern state, the most southern northern state, the most eastern western state, and the most western eastern state. Many West Virginians will tell you we belong with everyone, and yet we belong with no one. So when an article in the Washington Post depicted West Virginia as a strong blue state slowly becoming red, a phenomenon not unfamiliar to southern states, state leaders on the Democratic side were up in arms against the claim. State Democratic Party Chairman Larry Puccio.
In this past election, of all elections in the state of West Virginia, the fact is that Democrats won 67% of all the races, which left the Republican Party to win 33%. So there's not a question that it is a Democratic state.
However, Dr. Robert Rupp, history professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College, says historically we're following that trend the other southern states took decades ago.
The situation in West Virginia since basically starting in 2000 is a slow and sustained transition from an extremely loyal Democrat state to a Republican state, from a blue state to a red state. However, what's interesting about the transition is that unlike other states in the South, let's use Georgia for example, in which the transition happened in less than a decade, in West Virginia, the transition is slower and at different levels.
In the southern United States, once known as the Solid South because of the Democratic Party's political stronghold, things began to change in the early 1960s. The region became more urbanized and could no longer hold their ground on racial segregation. And they started voting Republican at the so-called top of the ticket for president.
I think that is the trend that we have seen through much of the South, which was very traditionally Democratic, which began to vote Republican at the top of the ticket, starting with Richard Nixon. And, you know, ultimately, for a lot of those states, again, my home state of Texas, places like Alabama, they have gone pretty deeply Mississippi, very deeply red.
National political correspondent for The Washington Post, Karen Tumulty, grew up in Texas and says the people she knew more than 30 years ago as Democrats now identify themselves as Republicans. Tumulty traveled to southern West Virginia four times over the summer, researching her article, A Blue State's Road to Red.
The one thing that was beginning to show up nationally in every poll was that American voters have never had a lower regard for the federal government.
And Tumulty says that low regard was nowhere more evident than in southern West Virginia.
Most of that transformation, the most dramatic change, has come about in coal country, which was, you know, so reliably Democratic, just up and down the ticket, and really has undergone a great change and continues to.
In 2000, West Virginia began to join the trend, voting for George W. Bush in two elections, followed by John McCain and Mitt Romney on the presidential ticket. State Republican Party Chairman Conrad Lucas says that's how it starts. The party switch starts with the voters at the office of president and slowly trickles down to the state and local levels.
It's definitely a top-down voting trend as opposed to bottom-up. Much like was written in the Washington Post, there are still county courthouses where there aren't Republicans elected. There are still counties that it's very difficult to find a Republican to run for House of Delegates or for any of the county offices, despite the fact that federally we are so solidly red now. So seeing that this trend is happening in the exact same sociological and political manner in which it did in other states indicates that we are no different than these other states in many ways. Politically, the trends are what they are, and we're certainly following a historical pattern.
Puccio agrees. We are following a historical pattern, just not the same one Lucas sees.
When folks are really down on the individual that's running for president, that does harm the rest of the party. And I think some of that showed up here. There's not a question that the favorability for our president is not high in West Virginia.
Rupp, however, is not sure. He believes that trickle-down pattern will follow in time.
West Virginia still has a 2-to-1 Democratic edge in registration. But the story in West Virginia is a state that's 2-to-1 Democratic is switching over to Republican. Now, what's even more interesting is that when you go down to Wyoming County, it's 7-to-1, 9-to-1 Democrats. So virtually everyone in that county is registered as a Democrat, but they're not voting as a Democrat.
Rupp says on the federal level, West Virginians are voting more and more to send Republicans to Washington, with the exception of Senator Joe Manchin. Rupp admits, though, Manchin isn't much of an exception.
In America, there are three political parties. There's the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and the West Virginia Democrats. And I say that because West Virginia Democrats have been able to keep control on the state level because, one, it's a huge, big tent in which you can have very conservative members feel comfortable in the Democratic Party as well as liberals. And for that reason, we can see the election of someone like Joe Manchin, even though the state seems to be shifting in a Republican direction.
Tumulty agrees. She says as she traveled the state, she could tell West Virginia Democrats were different. But that observation only reminded her of the transition she witnessed in Texas years ago.
Just about everybody you talk to can tell you of a grandfather or, you know, a great-grandfather who actually came to West Virginia to make a life for themselves and their family and find economic opportunity in the coal mines.
Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post and spent time this summer traveling southern West Virginia, talking to people.
The coal miner is such a part of the shared heritage of West Virginia that it really, you know, the industry has a significance, I think, that goes much, much deeper than economic statistics will tell.
But as the industry struggles, West Virginians often look to place the blame. And State Democratic Party Chairman Larry Puccio says today that blame is being shifted to Washington.
Well, the truth of the matter is I think that West Virginians believe not only the president is not doing enough to support the coal industry, they truly believe that the president, with some of his beliefs and restrictions, is harming the industry.
Puccio says leaders from his party inside the Beltway are making it clear they stand against the president and his position on coal. But with each election, the Democratic Party in West Virginia appears to be growing weaker as more and more Republicans are taking office. At least, that's how Tumulty depicts the party in her article, A Blue State's Road to Red.
The southern part of the state has traditionally been the most deeply Democratic part of the state. That is where the Democratic Party has always gotten the bulk of its of the votes with which it won statewide.
But Tumulty says that trend is changing. At the federal level, West Virginians are slowly turning away from their Democratic roots and voting Republican. She writes, quote, "What's happening in West Virginia runs against the tide nationally, and even more, against the pull of its own history."
If I have difficulty with the story, it is its concentration on the narrative in southern West Virginia.
Dr. Robert Rupp is a professor of history at West Virginia Wesleyan College. He questions Tumulty's ability to assert the entire state is experiencing this change in party when she focused only on one region.
Now, 50 years ago, southern West Virginia was the key economic driver. It was the key to the Democratic Party. It held political power. But now, in the 21st century, we have seen a rapid decline in all those factors, in terms of population, in terms of the economy, and in terms of political clout. So if you just visit this one section of where there is a decline in West Virginia, it's an interesting narrative to ask how those citizens are reacting. But I think it's a warped strategy because you're ignoring what's happening in the West in the rest of the state.
Rupp says the political center of the state is moving in a northeastern direction. Earl Ray Tomlin is the first governor since 1965 to truly come from southern West Virginia. Today, both the state House and Senate are led by northerners.
If you're really talking about looking at the entire state, then why visit those counties that have lost population rather than visit those counties that have gained in population and gained in the economy? There's an entire picture of West Virginia that is lost to a national audience when the focus of outside journalists are simply on one area in the southern part.
Tumulty counters she interviewed members of the governor's staff who represent the entire state, both U.S. senators who, again, together represent the entire state, and writes of the booming shale industry in the northern counties and a panhandle thriving as a suburb of D.C.
But what I was looking for was a way of explaining the transformation. And again, most of that transformation has been happening in the very deeply Democratic bastions of coal country.
Rupp, however, says he does agree with Tumulty's thesis that the state is transitioning between the two political parties. After all, the 3rd Congressional District is the only remaining seat in the U.S. House held by a Democrat in West Virginia. Historically, he says West Virginia is joining in with its southern cousins who followed the trend decades ago, but believes the other regions of West Virginia are still important to understanding the political change.
And I think if we really want to understand this transition, we have to be able to examine and explore what is happening politically in the other sections of the state, particularly in the Panhandle, because that's the fastest growing region, and any political party that is able to get the edge in that section will probably dominate the state, just as the Democrats were able to get the edge in the southern part 50 years ago and were able to dominate the state for a long time.
Tumulty says West Virginia will be a state to watch come the 2016 election. She contends that there's still a chance the right type of Democrat could win the state's vote for president and make a difference, even though it only carries 5 votes.
Well, if Al Gore had those 5 votes, he would be building his presidential library about now.
West Virginians are a proud people, proud most of all of their heritage. Almost any West Virginian can share his or her story of a parent or grandparent who came to the state to work in the factories, steel mills, or coal mines to provide for their families. But a part of that heritage is also political, and most West Virginians will tell you their parents and grandparents voted blue.
What we're finding is that when they say that they're a Democrat, they argue, well, my dad was a Democrat, or my granddad was a Democrat, and there's reluctance, one, to break with that tradition, and also a kind of continuance in which being handed down from generation to generation.
Dr. Robert Rupp is a professor of history at West Virginia Wesleyan College and says that has been the trend for at least 3 generations in West Virginia. My grandparents voted Democrat, my parents voted Democrat, so I vote Democrat. But in West Virginia, the tendency to vote blue is beginning to change, at least at the federal level. The state hasn't been won by a Democratic candidate for president since 1996 with Bill Clinton. 2 of the 3 seats in the U.S. House are held by Republicans, and next year, the state could possibly see its first Republican U.S. senator since the late 1950s.
You know, there's a real question, I think, over whether these people are ultimately going to change their identity and become Republicans, or, you know, whether there is enough of the Democratic Party in West Virginia's heritage that they will continue to be Democrats, at least in name.
Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Her article, A Blue State's Road to Red, focuses on the transition in party power in southern West Virginia.
West Virginians are so conservative, they vote Democrat out of tradition.
State Republican Party Chairman Conrad Lucas says that tradition is what's hindering his party's success at the state and local levels. West Virginians are so proud of their heritage, they don't want to let it go. But Lucas says they're slowly starting to see a change.
You know, I come from a long line of Lincoln County Democrats myself. So we see younger people in West Virginia being more willing to vote Republican than those who've been voting Democrat for so many generations, for election after election, and wanting to stay with their party. But it's younger folks who are realizing that the values of the National Democrat Party and the State Democrat Party don't align with their belief systems.
Rupp says nearly 60% of a person's party identification is based on family. But in West Virginia, the inclination to vote blue is starting to change, in part, Rupp says, just as Lucas sees it, because of a new generation of voters, millennials.
What we seem to be finding is that most Americans, but particularly this generation, are socially liberal on social issues and conservative on fiscal issues. Mainly, they want a small government and lower taxes, and they want that same small government to keep out of their private affairs. The difficulty is that neither the Republican or Democratic Party appear to offer both those conditions. So we have a generation that's kind of up for grabs, that's skeptical.
The transition, however, is happening at a slower rate than many other southern states that went through the same political shift decades ago. For example, Rupp says Georgia took less than 10 years to transition from a solidly blue to solidly red state. Part of the reason, Rupp accounts to the age of the average West Virginian. If the party switch is being pushed by the young voter, with the oldest median age of any state in the country, it's easy to see why the transition may take longer here than in the rest of the South. And then there's participation. Tumulty says young West Virginia voters' participation rates are among the lowest in the nation.
If you look at those voter turnout numbers, last year, voter turnout among the young plummeted in West Virginia. So certainly I talked to young people, I saw young people, but they more than any element of the population in West Virginia seem to be the ones who are just, you know, turning their backs on politics. And again, I think those voter turnout numbers are just speak volumes to that.
Low turnout, maybe because young voters feel outnumbered in an older state, or maybe because they don't seem to fit with either party. Rupp says either could be true. But if the parties can get millennials involved in the election process again, he believes we will see a change in results.
I think that is going to contribute, maybe not for a transition to total from Democrat to totally Republican, but it will mean more divided ballots. It will mean voting will be based on pragmatic issues rather than ideological issues or party issues. And I think in that way, if we do see this transition happening, we will give the key role will be what is this generation of young voters whose basically parents and grandparents simply continued allegiance to the Democratic Party, and now they're questioning if that allegiance should go.
Rupp says another contributing factor to the change in politics for young voters is the decreasing importance young people see in unions. Once a major part of the state's economic and political processes, Rupp says unions are becoming less important as we move away from an industry-based economy, having less influence over a new generation in the workforce. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. As the natural gas boom continues in northern West Virginia, some young people are finding work as pipe fitters. There's an apprenticeship school in Morgantown. West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board stopped to investigate and brings us this report.
There's a place in Morgantown where dreams of safe, lucrative occupation are envisioned and pipe fitters and plumbers are born. It's a 5-year apprentice program run by the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, Local 152. When apprentices leave, they walk away as certified welders, blueprint designers, crane signaling, card wielding union members.
A lot of the people that come here, they gravitated toward the Votex areas in high school. That's becoming more shunned socially now.
Jason Fidley came up through the apprentice program and graduated to journeyman status 5 or 6 years ago. The journeyman title comes with the completion of a certain amount of training and hours on the job. Today, Fidley is working in the northern gas fields as a pipe fitter, and he also teaches classes at the apprentice school.
You were always pushed to go to college. Some people just don't want to do that. And, I mean, I've made more than I would make with a college degree where I'm at now.
Fidley says he enjoys the sense of achievement he gets from accomplishing tasks like hoisting 5,000-pound pipes into place, but he most enjoys working with apprentices at the school where he gets to see them have what he calls light bulb moments.
Finding people that may have been having a little bit of difficulty in math or reading or even blueprint reading and being able to help them get to a point, A, that it betters themselves, but then also takes and elevates them to the next level to where they can go out and be successful in whatever part of this career they want to be in. that's a big, you know, cool moment.
It's a 5-year program. Generally runs like a regular school year, 2 nights a week. At the same time, the apprentices will be working out in the field during the day. So it can be a little bit of a grind, but it's all worth it in the end.
Chad Aleska is the Union Apprentice Program's assistant coordinator. He's also a journeyman and teaches first-year apprentices all the need-to-know basics of plumbing and pipe fitting.
Once they graduate the program as a journeyman, they can travel anywhere in the United States, Canada, and now Australia as a new member of the United Association of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters.
The program is available to anyone who's willing to take an aptitude test and be interviewed. And there's a special deal that streamlines the application process for veterans, like Matthew McGinnis.
When I got out, I was looking for, you know, for new work in the civilian world.
McGinnis was born and raised in Fairmont. He signed up as a soldier, and after serving his country for 6 years, he returned to West Virginia.
I've always enjoyed, you know, labor and building things with my hands and seeing a physical product at the end of the day of what I've done. So any type of building trade was something I was interested in, and it really just worked out well for me time-wise from when I came back home to when the apprenticeship was starting, and I came and did an interview, and here I am.
McGinnis is enjoying the program. He immediately began working in areas where he gets to put the knowledge he learns in classes to practical use. McGinnis is in his second year, which is entirely dedicated to learning how to weld, something he says he's always been interested in.
You have to learn things, and you have to have skills that you're actually good at so that you can be put to use for that. So that is my main goal, my main focus right now, is to learn everything that I can, and not just learn it, but actually become proficient in it. So, you know, I can be used for those abilities, and I'll be an asset.
McGinnis says he enjoys the camaraderie of working in the apprentice program within the union, and all the challenges and learning opportunities he's presented with in the classroom and out.
They tell you, you know, math and science are going to be important when you grow up, and it really is, because there's a lot of that that people don't even realize that's flowing in the building around them, you know, and they don't take it into consideration.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
The brilliant rust orange iron oxide that's pulled out of waterways polluted with acid mine drainage is finding its way into the hands of artists and craftspeople. The dried and powdered material is being used to color t-shirts, wood stain, concrete, and even the burnt sienna shade of Crayola crayons. Now, as the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan reports, a nonprofit is helping to turn creek contaminants into pottery glaze.
But yeah, this is just a liquid glaze.
Potter Bob Eisenberg dunks a mug into the grayish liquid. It's manganese.
A lot of times I'll just kind of do it. Just shake it around a little bit.
He's always used iron oxide and manganese in commercial glazes that come from around the world. A few years ago, this local alternative became available.
I think because they had larger particles, they did different things. They just were kind of runny, and they had a little like feathery details to them that our other glazes just didn't have.
About a half hour's drive from Eisenberg's studio is a double-wide trailer where Eisenberg gets his supplies. It's the headquarters of Stream Restoration Incorporated in Mars near Pittsburgh. The organization helps 20-some watershed conservation groups keep their water treatment systems up and running. Margaret Dunn and Ryan Mahoney walk around the back of the trailer.
Okay, Ryan, can you explain what we have in these sacks in the back?
Sure. When a system kind of reaches an age where it's getting clogged or there's too much manganese or iron in it, we go out and recover the materials. For the iron, it's kind of go get some interns or people from the office and shovel it into the bags. So it's kind of a dirty process.
Then they spread and dry it out. The groups pulled more than 20 tons of iron and manganese out of just a couple streams. Mahoney demos the next step, flipping on a commercial sifter.
Basically, once you turn it on, you just put the material in and it shakes and distributes.
The potters ask for particular sizes?
Yeah, some potters like larger sizes, some like raw materials, some like it very fine. It's going to be a little loud.
This whole operation came about after Dunn had a surprising conversation a few years ago.
Back in about 2005, my best friend, who is a potter, she recognized that material that we were collecting in our systems when we were treating mine drainage could be used by potters. She made a few pieces, and now we have 7 potters that contribute. And all the money from the sale of the material and from the pottery goes to help watershed groups sustain the treatment of their systems.
They call this project Clean Creek Products. Inside the trailer, Dunn shows off pieces made with glaze. They're artsy modern works, naturally, in earth tones. $20 to $30 for mugs, $25 for a set of earrings.
I typically wear some. I should have had some on today.
A sake set, flasks, and tea kettles round out the collection. And if it seems counterintuitive to drink from a cup made from what pollutes streams, well, Dunn explains it this way.
We've had the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, we've run tests to make sure that it could be used in the pottery safely and for food, and it meets all the criteria. And we were just surprised.
Do people ask that, though? Like, wait a minute, this is what's polluting streams.
You know, if you're taking a multiple vitamin, you're taking iron and manganese. When there's too much iron, then fish can't live. You know, it tends to kill the stream.
When she thinks about the implications, Dunn actually gets choked up.
I'm originally from southern West Virginia. There's a lot of poverty down there, a lot of mine drainage, and anything to help the communities is what we want to do.
I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The newest crayfish species bears a name that commemorates one of Appalachia's most famous feuds. West Liberty State University researcher Zach Lohman discovered the species and has named it Camberis hatfieldi. It will also be known as the Tug Valley crawfish and is common on Mate Creek near Red Jacket, which is in the heart of Hatfield-McCoy country. It's the third new crayfish species Lohman has discovered. Every year at this time since 1900, bird enthusiasts have taken to the great outdoors for the annual Audubon Society Bird Count. The goal? To monitor the status and distribution of the winter bird population. Those who can't go out to count birds can keep track of the species visiting their feeders. The count started December 14th and ends this weekend. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel went on one bird count in southwestern Pennsylvania and has this report.
In the basement of the Taylorstown Christian Church, Larry Helgerman is organizing stacks of Google Maps and birdwatching checklists on long tables which are usually reserved for church suppers. He's been in charge of this bird count for 11 years, and he's all smiles, even though it's still dark outside.
But just keep your checklist separate, okay? If you can.
It's sure. Just after 7 a.m., and the bird counters are arriving to pick up their instructions and find out which section of a 15-mile circle they'll cover today. They eat cupcakes with red and green sprinkles and drink coffee as they wait for their assignments.
All areas have a chance of finding good things.
From red cardinals to ring-necked pheasants with rust-colored bellies. Young and old bird enthusiasts, men and women from 3 states and 8 counties are participating. About 40 people will count birds from their cars or while walking through nearby fields and roads. Bruce Ettinger has been doing Christmas bird counts since he was a teenager.
It's a very long-lasting, well over 100 years history to the Christmas bird count as an alternative to the rather gruesome custom in the past of going out on Christmas Day and shooting as much wildlife and see who had the biggest pile.
Ettinger's brought his 9-year-old daughter, Erica, for her first count. She's bundled up in a pink hat and carries a tabbed Peterson's Field Guide for birds. She's got an idea of what she hopes to spot.
Ducks, or Dad said like a tree sparrow would be a good bird to see, or a snowy owl would be a really good bird.
Friends Mary Gray and Robin Estep are also counting birds today. Estep claims to be a beginner, but she's got a pair of telltale binoculars that cross behind her back, which all the pros use.
I just really like to come to the Christmas bird counts because especially if it's snowing, it just gets me in the Christmas spirit. You know, I just love it.
And it is snowing, lightly. It's about 30 degrees, but the wind makes it feel colder. Outside the White Country Church, the small town is decked out for Christmas. Many of the old Victorian homes look like gingerbread houses already. Our section is right around the church. Gray says for bird counting, you don't need a lot of equipment, just your ears, eyes, and a checklist of all the birds we might see. She gives a quick bird count 101.
You count the highest number you see. So if you look in a tree and there's, say, four starlings, there's something flying there, Robin, up over those trees, and you look back again and there's six starlings, then you know six. It's not an exact science.
It's citizen science. The data is used to track bird migrations and population changes. It's Sunday morning, and the small town roads are quiet. That's a good thing, since we're looking up as we walk. There are mourning doves, motos for short, crows, chickadees, a white-breasted nuthatch, male and female juncos, the males are darker, and then, near a backyard bird feeder, something that really gets Gray's attention.
He was on the fence, clinging to the fence, and he flew up, and he's going to be on the side. He's just coming up on the right-hand side of this branch. He's underneath. Come here this way.
It's a brown creeper, working his way from the bottom of the trunk up, looking for insect eggs and larvae.
Brown creeper's a good bird for a town bird.
Did you hear that little high drawn-out note he just gave Robin? That little chish, almost sounds like, hear that?
Yeah.
That's him.
Gray says seeing a creeper in a residential area might mean they had a good breeding year, and there are a lot of young birds looking for new territory. Later, Helgerman heads to a marshy area near game lands, where he hopes to see some swamp and white-crowned sparrows. There's still water and lots of seeds here for them to eat, so they may stay through the winter. He trudges through tall brown grass and briars. Waterproof boots are a good idea on a bird count. Helgerman makes a pishing sound to draw out some of the songbirds.
That was one swamp sparrow right there. I know they're in here. And bluebirds. We should be having seen some bluebirds. I haven't even heard any bluebirds yet.
He says anyone can be part of the count. It helps to go out with someone experienced like him and to keep your ears open.
You don't even pay attention to sounds anymore. Just start to learn to tune in to what you're actually hearing around you. And you'll start hearing squirrels. You'll hear chipmunks. You'll hear all these things that, you know, you were oblivious to.
After about 4 hours, we head back to the church. Mary Gray carves a ham, and the birders are gathering around the tables, eating, warming up, and comparing notes. Erica Edinger wants to talk about one bird her dad saw.
Kestrel.
A kestrel?
Yeah. Well, I might have saw it like flat. I only saw like a silhouette.
With a kestrel added to her list, she has some advice for bird counting success.
I had a lot of jackets, and Dad brought hot chocolate.
She says she'll be back to check off more birds next year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.